Well, I'm going to invite Danny up now, and we're going to have a little chat first, because I know that while some have met Danny, not all have. And so we're going to find a little bit more about Danny before he comes and brings God's word to us. So, Danny, it's great to have you here in person.
Thank you for having me.
Very good. Can you just tell us a bit about yourself first?
So, my name's Danny. I live in Caterham in Surrey, not very far from here. Our office is at International Needs, are based in Selsdon in Surrey, again, not very far. I'm married, 27, my wife Roz is watching, so I better get this right. 28 years, we've been married 28 years. We have two boys. One is currently in his third year in university and enjoying student life, not as we know it, I guess. Yeah. And my other son is a surveyor. He's working in London. He works from home, so... Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Okay, that's really good. And how you mentioned International Needs and you're the UK director. How did you get into that? Where did you come from? What brought you into it?
A bit of a strange route, really. I used to be a sales and marketing director of a software company based in California, Silicon Valley company, and I ran European sales. And I remember enjoying what I was doing. I loved it. But there was this came a time when I was praying in my quiet times with God and just saying, well, what is this really the rest of my life? I'm just going to make shareholders rich. And, God led me to thinking about something different. I had no idea it would be being the CEO of a mission agency that was doing works across parts of the world. But I remember seeing this advert. My wife said to me, what do you think about this? I was thinking about something else in, line of work. What do you think about this? And I thought, oh, they won't want me. They'll want somebody who's been a pastor, someone who's been, who's got real proper mission experience, And so I applied anyway. I thought I would do it. I went there in my sharp suit and I met these trustees of this mission agency and I presented them some thoughts and plans and they said, we like you. And then that afternoon, they invited me to see if I wanted that job. So I went from being a sales and marketing director to being the CEO of a tiny little mission agency and it was amazing, amazing.
I think that's fascinating at all sorts of levels, not least this idea that people think that for you to go and work in a mission organisation or even for a church, the skill set you need is primarily one-to-one counselling or things like that. People have this image, don't they? And actually, the skill set of a marketing and salesperson is fantastic for all sorts of paid Christian roles. And it's great to hear about software. If you could just put us in contact with somebody who could sort out our technical problems, that'd be wonderful. And so finally, before I let you sort of loose on God's word, what have been, obviously COVID must have been a massive challenge for International Needs. What have been sort of the big challenges and opportunities for you of this?
I was talking with Roz earlier when I met in the church, and we met just literally before lockdown, and we had no idea at that point, what was going to happen. Like the rest of us, we didn't know that we were all going to have a very different year. And we had all these hopes and aspirations of these projects we're running. Lockdown is what is hurting our partners. It's the impact of lockdown. These nations shut their economies down. They shut their public transport down. And it was just instant problem. In a nation where you use your daily labor to earn a wage to feed your family, that was taken away from you. So we went into emergency mode. We're not a relief agency, but we had to go into relief and we had to just help our partners. How do we protect life? Mm. And how do we support them? How do we deliver food? How do we get essential medical supplies to them? And so we went from projects that were all ongoing and we were hoping to raise funds for to immediately emergency relief. And as we come to the end of this year and I think about it, we've got to live with this pandemic. How is that going to shape our mission? How's that going to shape development, And we're starting to really think about that. What is God saying through all of this to us and how will we shape it? So that's the big challenge.
That's really helpful. Actually, in there you mentioned you're not a relief organisation, you're a sort of development organisation. For some people, I suppose we're a little unclear as to what that distinction is. Could you just talk a bit more about that?
So normally relief is a situation where you go into a situation like an earthquake or there's been civil conflict, and relief agencies, they fly people in, they immediately stop the bleeding. Mm. That's what they do. But of course, relief agencies are good at that, but then what happens is then you have to go on, and the next stage is to rehabilitate and recover. And that's where the long-term work of projects involves in development. How do you help a community then get back on its feet after you've stopped the bleeding? Mm-hmm. So it's a rehabilitation and a recovery,
yeah,
and a restoration. And that's, yeah, what we've been doing, working with our communities. But we put Christ at the center of that, because Christ is the one who, when you have a relationship with Christ, it means that it'll affect your relationship with all of your neighbors.
Yeah.
And that's one of the most beautiful things I love about the way that we work in our mission agency.
Okay, well, listen, thank you very, very much. I'm going to hand over to you, and looking forward to hearing you bring God's word to us.
Thank you. Well, I really appreciate your support as a church. Really thank... I met with Roz in March, I think, and what a year to be a mission agency and to be a church. We've all had our lives turned upside down. But I want to say thank you for supporting and praying with us this year. Thank you. And I want to show a few of our, just a couple of slides to show you a little bit about a particular project that I talked to Roz about. And it's, I don't know if I've got it back up here on the... Okay, is it on? Okay. All right. Okay. Okay, brilliant. Thank you. Yeah, so we're about families. And there is a Nepali family eating in the foothills of the Himalayas. And we work in many different countries in Africa. We work in many countries in Asia. We're actually part of a network. So our little small agency in the UK, we're not alone. We have an international leads agency in Canada, in Australia, in New Zealand. But we focus on families and communities. And we focus on empowering those communities and the leaders of those communities to be able to solve some of the biggest problems that they face. When I first took over as CEO, the first emergency that hit us was that the earthquake in Nepal happened. And if you see those pictures that I'm showing you, we had projects around the whole of districts of Nepal where we were supporting pastors who were planted in districts around Nepal. And in one district in particular was affected by the earthquake, very close to the Tibetan border, a district called Sindelpachuk. And if you look at the first picture, that actually once was the pastor's house, if you just see rocks. So let me help you with this statistic. In Sindelpachuk, in the villages of this population, the entire population of this district, 80% of them lost their houses. They collapsed, 80%. Imagine 8 out of every 10 houses in your street gone. Now, that's what happened in the earthquake. And so we weren't a relief agency. You know, many different agencies came in and helped Nepal with the rebuilding of houses. If you see the other picture, the other thing about the earthquake, I always love to point out to people, if you live in a mountainous country, it isn't just about the ground shaking and houses collapsing. It's about boulders rolling down from the mountains. So if you see that picture, you'll see boulders rolling into the building. And that entire town was flattened. I went there 6 months after the earthquake, and the entire town was abandoned. One of the things that this earthquake did was it ruined people's livelihoods. They farm in terraces in this area, in the foothills and the Himalayas. They lost their livestock because the livestock was crushed under the... So we decided we needed to help. And this is Pastor Rocker and his wife, who planted that church. If you see that little building in the grass there, you'll see that. They planted that church in 2009 with about 5 worshipping families there who'd come to know Jesus. To date, that has now about 75 families. They have to have 2 services in order to accommodate the amount of families that are. But what we wanted to do was the wider community was affected. They were so affected by the earthquake. How do we restore their livelihoods? And we first had to work with Pastor Rocker to enable him to have the resources to bring people together, to create a cooperative so that people could restore their livestock and their crops and start to work together and then flourish as a community. And by putting the church at the center of the community, it meant that we started to see the different barriers. One of the barriers in Nepal is a caste system. And if you don't know about a caste system, it's a structure in society. You're born into a caste, and often different castes do not interact with other castes. If you're of a high caste, you certainly don't interact with a low caste. How do you get neighbours to work together in that situation? How do you get them? Because they need each other to cooperate with each other. And one of the things that we've seen with Pastor Rocker, who himself is one of the untouchables, he comes from a low caste. He started to work with us in this livelihoods. We started to resource him with expertise and funds. And he's been able to restore some of the livelihoods of many of these different families. One of the greatest things, the impact of the gospel here, is that the Brahmins, the high caste, who would never have anything to do with him or the church or the Christians, have realized that they can work with us too. And when I was there last year, I took a team from Emmanuel Church in Croydon, and we went and slept on that church floor. The Brahmins from the village came down and ate with us. Now, if you know anything about the caste system, you'll know that is truly, truly exceptional. That's the impact of the gospel. And so we've helped someone like Parmina here, who's 32 years old, and she lost her husband, and she had four children. She was the breadwinner and the caregiver for the family. She now has a chicken farm from this livelihood business. She's growing broilers, and she markets them with others in the village, and they have a big market down in the valley, and they can sell. So I'm going to stop there, and I don't need any more slides. But I want to bring you this story about the Good Samaritan, because it is reflected in the work that we're doing with this project. This story, I love the way that you're looking at God's dictionary. How does a word, how is it redefined by God's dictionary, neighbor? And when you think of the word neighbor, what do you think of? Because this story is essentially about loving a neighbor and asking and identifying who that neighbor is. It's central to the passage. The old English word for neighbor is nearbur, if I can pronounce it correctly, which means nigh, you're near, and a boor is someone who owns a farm or a livelihood or a subsistence farming. It's where the Afrikaners get the word boor. So neighbor, you're near. Of course, for us today, what does a neighbor mean? You know, for me, it was words of a pop song that I used to listen to. Wouldn't it be nice if I could get on with my neighbors? They make it very clear they've got no time for ravers. You might remember the pop song, you might not. But, of course, I always feel slightly guilty about my neighbour. Do I know my neighbours? Because we live such busy lives. In fact, we live less at home and more at work. Maybe that's changed through this pandemic. But do we really know our neighbours? Do we know? Do we love them? Being neighbourly is now like an adverb. It's been seen doing good. But our neighbours aren't just those that are geographically close to us. In fact, now we see, through Zoom and technology that we've got, neighbours can be very far geographically, but sometimes we see them as people that are like us. You know, they went to the same schools as us, they're from the same background as us, they look like us, they have the same religion as us. But of course we live in a global village, and a global village means that everyone is essentially becoming our neighbour. So in this particular passage, what you see is Jesus questioning a lawyer or a teacher of the law. Now, he's not a lawyer like we would understand. He works for Streeter Marshall in Croydon. No, he's a lawyer. He's an expert in the Old Testament law, the Torah. And this lawyer knows that in Leviticus 19, verse 18, the first time ever, God speaking through Moses, he says to the people, love your neighbor as yourself. And if you read on through that, the whole book, and of course at the end of that chapter, it's all about laws, and at the end of it, they've recasted that word to love your stranger, the stranger. He's not like you. Doesn't worship the same God as you, but lives in your midst. Worship the stranger. It's recasted and redefined the word neighbor to the stranger as yourself. So it's actually a very good question that's asked. Do you know, when you think about the story of the Good Samaritan, of course, the thing that you're drawn to is the story, isn't it? The Levite, the priest, what they did, the good works, and you think about that. But actually what you've really got to do is step outside of the story and look at the context. Who is Jesus talking to?
and look at the dialogue that he's having. That will enlighten you as you look at it. I must admit, as I read this, I enjoyed it. It gave me a chance to remind myself of what I've missed from this parable. And I want to share a few things that I've missed and then share three very simple lessons with you from this. The first thing is the guy isn't a lawyer. And I know with the version that we read from says he's a, but in many versions it says a lawyer. He was a theologian, an expert in the law. He knew the Torah. He knew the first commandment, the greatest commandment, to love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind. And then the second, to love your neighbor as yourself. He knew it. But did he act it? Did he have it in his heart? We know many things when we go to church, but do we actually take them in? Do we actually act on those things? So the second thing I noticed is it's a strange question that he asks Jesus. Why is it strange? Because he uses the word inherit. What shall I do to inherit? Well, if you inherit something, you're normally given it. It's not because what you do. My mum and dad aren't going to leave their worldly possessions to me because I've done this, I've done that. I hope they aren't anyway. But the fact is, I inherit because I'm a son. I'm a family member. So it's a strange question, isn't it? What should I do to inherit? It's a paradox, almost. And the third thing that struck me was the circumstances around this parable, I've said, are essential for us understanding it. Jesus sets his face to go to Jerusalem, it says in Luke 9. He is on his way to a destiny that will only end at the cross. He is on his way there. He says to his disciples, let these words sink into your ears. The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men. And then secondly, what a wonderful way Jesus is dialoguing. Look at the way that he masterfully questions the lawyer or the teacher of the law. It's fascinating, isn't it? If you answer questions with questions. Have you ever had that experience? You're explaining something and somebody, instead of giving you an answer, asks you a question back. You know, as a Christian, sometimes when I want to tell other people about my faith and somebody says to me, so are you seriously telling me that if I reject God, I'm going to hell? Is that what you're saying to me? I could respond, well, let me tell you about the nature of hell and judgment and you understand the position of creation and the fall. And you've probably lost them at that point. What if you answer with a question? You could say, so, what do you think nobody deserves punishment? Question. Answer a question with a question. Jesus is a master at this. It helps appropriate the truth. The next thing is that, why does he make the Samaritan the hero of the story? Well, most of us sort of know a little bit about this, that the Samaritans were hated by the Jews. They were hated for the very reason that they were sort of half-breeds. They were Jews that had intermingled with the other races in. They had developed another temple on Mount Gerizim. They were despised by the Jews because they took on some Jewishness, but not. And so they were worse than foreigners to the Jews. They were very, very hated and despised. In the chapter before, Jesus has been rejected by a Samaritan village, if you read in Luke chapter 9. He's rejected, and James and John, who are so incensed by this, want to call down fire on a Samaritan village. I wonder if it had been a Jewish village, they might not have been so incensed. But Jesus illustrates why we need to think about the Samaritan in this sense. So there were things that jumped out at me. And I hope there are things that jump out at you in this parable, that you don't just accept it. But there are three things that I want to just share with you as I close. Folks, it's not enough just to see a need. It's not enough just to see it. Because if you look at the way that Jesus describes the reactions of these three men, they all saw. They saw. It's not enough. How do you fare here? I've got to admit, I marvel sometimes at my own hardness of heart. I was, and particularly if I'm busy. I was on my way to a major donor. The donor was meeting me at a club in Pall Mall. That'll tell you about why I needed to be quite on time. And I was late for the train. I was rushing to the station. a man grabs me. He's disheveled. He's got blood on his face. He's looking confused. And he says, "Can you help me? Can you help me?" Oh, no, not now. Why now? Just as I was thinking that, a lady I recognized from my another church in my town had been watching this man. She just literally walked into my field of vision. "I've been watching him. Let me help. Let me help. Would you like a cup of coffee? Let me send." I said, "Thank you." And I walked on. What would I have done? I was my agenda. I was doing my things. What would I have done? I'm challenged by my own hardness of heart. It's not enough just to see a need. The second thing is, what you do is determined by what you see. The Samaritan had a difference because he saw, and the next thing is he had compassion. His agenda became not important to him at that point. He may have been on his way to meet a major donor or some business meeting or whatever. His agenda became unimportant to him. The agenda of the man became important. He had compassion. He acted. He bandaged the stranger. Did he have bandages on him? No, he probably tore his own clothes to bandage the stranger, bruised with open wounds. He took wine and he took oil and he bandaged. He then went further, as we heard earlier. He loaded the man on a donkey or an animal, it says. And then he paid to the innkeeper of the inn 2 denarii. Well, I always wonder what a denarii is, so I looked it up. But one denarii is the equivalent of one day's wage. So if you take 2 days' wages, and if you imagine perhaps earning 2 days and giving it to a total stranger. I looked at the government website for the median wage of somebody in the southeast. It was something like £600 a week. That's median, the middle. So if you imagine that, you divide that by two, this is someone that you would give £250 to, a complete stranger. Now, I'm trying to quantify it because I want to show you it wasn't just a few coins in his pocket. It was 2 days' labor. What you do is determined by what you see. But the third thing that the lesson is this, is that what you see is determined by what you are. And I'll illustrate it like this. My wife and I and my son, we love going walking, and particularly in the times of lockdown, we loved walking with our dog. We love to walk past perhaps an old house that I haven't seen before in the street, and we look at the house, and I'll look at it, and I'll say, "Well, that's a beautiful house. Look, it's from the 18th century. I might even know the age of it. I might even think, oh, I'd like to live there one day. Look at that." My wife will look at the same house, and she will say, "Look at that garden. Wonderful flower beds. How beautiful that is." My son, he's a commercial surveyor. He will tell me about the bricks, and he'll tell me what age the house is by the bricks. What we are is what we see. How do we truly become people who see people and love them? Was Jesus giving this lawyer and all the listeners an impossible task? To love God and to love our neighbor as ourselves, is that impossible? Well, actually, we suck at it, don't we? As a human race, we suck at this. You know, there are many people who do amazing things, and they do amazing things for helping others. But in general, we collectively suck at this. How do we love God and love our neighbors as ourselves? And as I said at the beginning, Jesus was on his way to Jerusalem. He was going to provide the answer to that question. We need help. We need a change of heart. We need a new heart. It says in Ezekiel, "I'll give you a heart of flesh. I'll replace that heart of stone within you." God is calling us to respond to his love, demonstrated at the cross, giving his life for his people. And when we take that and we appropriate that into our hearts, we begin to love God. And we can then begin to love our neighbors as ourselves. Mother Teresa, the great good neighbor of all, the great, great Samaritan, she said, "Not all of us can do great things, but we can do small things with great love. God bless you. Thank you.